Today, we're in an age where brand matters. People want to buy. They want to learn things. They want to be involved in things. They know they could get the information anywhere, but they specifically want to learn it from you.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. This week, we have the man, the myth, the legend, Ryan Dice. Today's episode is a treasure chest of takeaways, tidbits, and inspiration. And most importantly, a peek into the mindset that brought you the invisible selling machine, traffic and conversion, and all things digital marketer.
This is Roland Frazier with Business Lunch, and I am here today with my business partner and friend, Ryan Dice, in Ryan's office.
Yes. Welcome.
So I'm really excited to have you here because I have learned so much about people as I interviewed them for the show. And it's really cool that people that you have known for a long time, you just don't know all of the backstory. So I've heard your story from the TNC presentations with the in the blue tight spandex suit, but I don't know completely. And I heard you telling Rachel Hollis and Amy Porterfield last night a little bit about it, but that was only the ear hustling while listening to other conversations. So tell me, where did the whole internet thing start for you?
It was 1999. I was a freshman at the University of Texas at Austin. And like every other kid in college, I was broke. You're supposed to be when you're in college. Even if you're not, you pretend like you are so you fit in.
I was going to say, you can't fit in if you're not.
Exactly. You don't want to be that one rich guy and everybody else is eating ramen. But now, I mean, I was paying my way through school. I had some grants and some scholarships and some loans, you know, so I needed a part-time job to help make some extra money, but it wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. I needed to generate some more revenue. Then that was the time when, yeah, Emily and I met. That was kind of when it hit me, like, I'm really going to need like a lot of money at some point.
Right. I met my wife.
Yeah.
And I know I need a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was right. No, but I just kind of started looking for opportunities. And you think about what was going on in 1999. That was kind of right before the first dot-com bubble sort of burst. So, I mean, it was enthusiasm was still really high. Michael Dell had started Dell Computer Company. And, you know, you're hearing stories of all these like Dellionaires, you know, yep. And the mythology of that and this idea that you can start a business from your dorm room. That's when you really started to hear about, mm-hmm. about this. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm in a dorm room. You know, I'm looking across the street at another dorm room. That's where Michael Dell started Dell Computer. You know, hey, why can't I? What I wanted to do at the time is I really wanted to get a job with a startup.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So back then, when I was Austin startup-y at that time?
Yeah, I mean, so there's Dell and there's Motorola. They called it like the Silicon Hills.
Okay.
But it was mostly hardware and chip manufacturing and that kind of thing. So I'm thinking, you know, certainly in the way that people think about startups right now, like the Silicon Valley type culture, that mm-hmm. wasn't here yet. Mm-hmm. Social media wasn't here yet. Mm-hmm. Google wasn't really even a thing yet. So I just wanted to go and work for one of these startup companies because the general idea then was you could get in on the ground floor, you could get some stock options, and you know eventually when that company went public, you'd be rich. I mean, there yep. were stories, whether they're true or not, I don't know, but there were stories about somebody who was a janitor at Dell and you know he got stock options and then
I guess next if it was thing, early you know, enough
a billionaire. Exactly. Yeah. And that was the thing. It was generally understood companies back then would just hand out stock options to anybody. And this is pre-Enron and mm-hmm. all that. So, I mean, they're just flinging around stock options like crazy. Companies were going public really quickly. You know, today, companies don't really go public for long. The private markets are so frothy, they can stay private for much longer than...
And sometimes it's dangerous going public exactly. because you're down. Yeah.
Back then, companies would raise some initial angel money on the back of a napkin, kind of get some proof of concept with a product, and then go public pre-revenue. There were companies going public right. pre-revenue. They all went out of business for very obvious reasons.
Right.
But at the time, that's all I was thinking. I want to get in on the ground floor of one of these companies so I can do as little work as possible, get a bunch of stock options. When the company goes public, I can get rich. So I'm asking around to anybody I know, like, you know, who will hire me for their startup? And I, when interviewed at this marketing company, they were doing targeted email marketing, also known as spam. Mm-hmm. You know, at a time before Can Spam Act happened, they were harvesting email addresses from forums and spamming on behalf of massive brands.
Right.
So I want to make sure that I say this. I don't want people thinking that like I'm proud of this. It was a very different time.
Right.
Truly at that time, people were just happy to hear you've got mail.
Plus you were just getting into it. So it's not like you knew a whole lot about
it. Didn't know anything. The laws weren't you know, there yet. And so I kind of heard through a friend of a friend of a friend that they were maybe looking at hiring a web designer. So I went and interviewed and I said, I'm willing to work for free. And they said, do you know how to design websites? I said, of course I do, which is totally not true. Mm-hmm. But I figured, I interviewed
that
on a Thursday. I was going to start work and I figured I could learn.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I show up for work and they're like, well, we need you to design these landing pages for our clients. Because they were pretty sophisticated at the time. They weren't just trying to spam for the sake of spamming. Their model was, we're essentially going to send out these targeted email blasts to get people to come to a landing page, mm-hmm. right? Now everybody knows about landing page. At the mm-hmm. time, they called them splash pages,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
So we want to get people to click on an email, go to a splash page, and re-opt in. So they were building email lists for these big companies, like InStyle Magazine was one of their clients. So really innovative at the time,
yeah.
this idea of we're going to send emails, but we don't want to be overly spammy or obnoxious. We want to send emails to some type of a free offering mm-hmm. on a splash page to get them to opt in. And then
so they were lead magneting.
Exactly. They were doing lead magnets in 1999, pre-Y2K kind of thing. So really smart. And the way they ran their business, if you unsubscribed, they actually took you off the list.
Ooh,
yeah.
Nice.
So they were really just
actually
top.
Legit.
Yeah, actually legit. Exactly. So the funny thing was, they were not impressed at all with my web design abilities because I didn't know how to do all the fancy flash animation. Mm-hmm. You remember when you used to go to websites
yeah.
and you'd show up and like there was this intro video?
Yep.
I didn't know how to do that.
Yep.
The only type of web page that I knew how to design was a simple table.
Mm-hmm.
And I would make the background color something that wasn't white, mm-hmm. you know, so I'd do like a, you know, light blue or something like that. And it'd just be a table with a border and I could do a headline and I could do an opt-in box mm-hmm. in there and like a picture of whatever the
shockingly
thing is we were
close
giving
to what
away.
They look like today.
Shocking. And now, so they were going to fire me because I wasn't actually that good.
Uh-huh.
Thankfully, they were doing split testing
uh-huh.
back then, really before anybody else.
Really,
really, really innovative.
These guys
company.
Sound like...
Yeah, they were great. I mean, I learned a ton.
Huh.
And what they found was that my ugly, simple pages got way higher conversion rates than the fancy ones.
Right.
So they kept me around. And
this
actually
is also
like,
at a time when the loading times for those things was,
oh,
God, awful.
Yeah,
the,
you'd go to a web page and you'd watch it like appear like line,
yes,
one line at a
exactly.
time. And mine just fired up. So it's funny, the types of pages I was designing back then are now exactly what is just best practice today.
Mm-hmm.
And I arrived there first, not because I had this brilliant insight about like, oh, short form copy and simple and just get to the point, have a headline. It's all I knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's literally the only thing, center a headline, make it a little bit bigger. It's all I knew how to do and it just happened to work. I just kind of got lucky. Because I can assure you, if I had learned over that weekend
mm-hmm.
how to design fancy flash animation, I would have done that.
Right.
I would have done that, and it probably still wouldn't have been as good as the real person would have got
would
fired.
Would it be fair to say that you invented the landing page?
I invented the entire internet.
Nice.
I invented buttons and clicks.
All right.
No, none of that would be fair to say. I accidentally came up with a really simple way of doing it that just happened.
And it's still working to this day. That's the super cool fun
still
thing.
Working to this day. If I compare the landing pages I designed in 1999 to the ones that we're running today, they would look remarkably similar. So that's where I got my start. And that company wound up going out of business. And I remember being really disappointed because I had just gone from working for free to actually getting on salary. Like
right.
they promoted me. I remember they flew me out to New York City and I sat in the Time Warner building
oh,
and
wow.
met with all these companies to talk about our campaigns and they wanted me to
That must
to
have been
explain.
Pretty cool.
It was great. Yeah. I mean, I'm a kid and
right.
I'm meeting with publishing
brands.
Executives and real brands,
yeah.
you know, I'm going on a business trip. I remember getting, you know, permission from my professors to miss and explaining like, yeah, that's great. So I'm thinking this is going to be awesome. I'm going to negotiate, you know, stock options and all this stuff. Well, the company went out of business because when the canned spam regulations came, they didn't really know how to pivot. And they're like, our business model just isn't going to work. So we're done.
Mm.
And they just shut it down. And so I've got this kind of pseudo skill of knowing how to do websites, but just barely. So I'm like, I guess to make ends meet, I'll try to just get a job as a web designer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody was hiring, you know, really at this point. Kind
right.
of the dot-com bubble was beginning to burst. And
it's a really bad time to be out of a job looking
yeah.
for a job.
Yeah. And again, you know, thankfully, I think a sophomore in college at this point.
Yeah.
Like, I'm okay. Like, I'm going to survive.
Right.
But the only client that I could get, so I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to do client work, was a lactation consultant.
Okay.
And so I'm like, trying to build this website for a lactation consultant, which if you don't know what a lactation consultant is, you know, it's a usually a woman who helps new moms figure out, like, through the nursing process, through the process of learning how to nurse their babies. Now, I got four kids today. My wife nursed all of our kids.
So you had good training, though, for that.
So now it's like, this is great. This is all wonderful. It's a beautiful thing. At 19, it was incredibly awkward.
What did you tell people you did?
And your friends think that you're... Well, I told them, like, yeah, I'm doing web design. Like, who's some of your clients? Like, people and stuff.
Big in the dairy industry.
And I remember Jordan... So you know Jordan, yeah. You know, my best friend, he's now one of our attorneys, helps us out with some things. Brilliant, brilliant guy.
Best
you know.
Friend, really? That yeah. hurts, but fine. Yeah. You know.
Well, I have known him since third grade, but roommate, and he's kind of like, comes in, he sees all these, you know, pictures on my computer of, you know,
like
breast
dude,
pumps
you have a weird
and nursing
fetish.
Pads, and he's like, what is this? I'm like, I promise I'm building a website for this lady. fast forward, this is a really long story, but God dang, this was forever ago and over the course of a while, so... I built the website. It was great. She couldn't pay me. Her husband lost his job. So she now had to go back to work. She wasn't going to be able to keep doing her practice. But again, she was smart. I was so fortunate early on to just stumble across people who were innovators without even realizing it, right?
Yeah.
Innovating with the landing page and lead magnets and these kind of things. What she did is she recognized that her clients, they essentially would graduate from her. Like once she taught them how to nurse, they didn't need her anymore. And she wanted to keep getting paid. After that.
Right.
So she actually had this ebook written on how to make your own baby food.
Wow.
So she's like, I want to move beyond, like after, you know, the kids weaned, I want to help them just have more nutritious food for their kids. Again, really insightful. Like this is the upsell.
And we're actually thinking about recurring
extension.
Revenue
exactly.
Way back then.
All the way back then. So long story short, when her husband lost her job and she had to give that up, kind of the only thing that she had that was of any value, she's like, well, I have this ebook. Why don't you take it? Maybe you can sell it and make some money because I feel bad that I can't pay you. And I'm thinking, what the heck am I going to do with an ebook on how to make your own baby food? And I was like, this is utterly worthless to me, but thank you, lady. So fast forward like a couple months and I realize, you know, I've overspent on some things. I'm going to have a really hard time making the rent.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm motivated. Like, I got to figure out a way to make some money. Like, well, and I think like, oh, I got that book. Let me see if I can figure something out. One night, built a really simple one-page website, long form sales copy talking about why you needed to make your own baby food. And I'd begin studying copywriting at this point.
Who were you reading?
Gary Halbert, Dan Kennedy, you know, kind of all the classics. Because my job that I was doing was I was essentially a marketing intern for a financial planner.
Right.
He did these free workshops, these free lunches
okay.
where you'd invite people.
Lunch and learn.
Yeah, like a lunch and learn.
Yeah.
And so I would do postcard campaigns to targeted areas to promote that. So it was offline. But I knew I still needed to learn basic copywriting. So in trying to figure out how do I do direct mail, I'm applying the things that I'm learning
things.
In my day job to the internet. Like instead of sending out a letter, what if I put the letter on the internet?
Right.
So again, this is no like brilliant insights. It's now what we know.
So
just
you were
works
putting
best
the files
today.
In the computer.
Files were going in the computer to then be put on the line. So I was like, I guess I'll write one of the letters like I'm write for this financial planner to help fill this thing to sell this ebook, which is just a PDF. Sold it for $14, you know, set up a PayPal account because that was the only way that I could take money.
Yeah.
Put up the website. I remember optimizing for Lycos and Alta Vista and all these things. And, you know, I remember, you know, back then within a couple of days, if you did it right, you could get ranked.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just remember going to bed, waking up the next morning and I had a sale. I made $14. I was like, okay, that was cool. What if I do more of these? And so I just decided to do more. I would license software and I'd sell. So I sold like pop-up blockers and things like that. I also sold pop-up creators.
Nice.
I figured I could be on both sides of that market. But all the same way, just long form, optimize for it. Then GoTo.com came out.
Yep.
Do you remember GoTo?
Yeah, I do.
The very first pay-per-click search engine.
Yeah.
It then became Overture. It was acquired by Yahoo, became Yahoo.
Yahoo
Search Network. And then some people were poached away from there to actually help create Google AdWords. And that really is where it kind of all came. Then I realized, gosh, I'm just going to sell digital products online through these simple one-page websites. By the time I graduated from college, I had a couple hundred of them, all making some money. People were asking me, hey, how are you doing this? So I then started a little email list where I was talking about marketing things. It's called the Web's Worth Watching newsletter.
The Web's Worth Watching?
Web's Worth Watching, yeah.
Nice.
I would send out some like cool websites and things that I thought were interesting
to
read.
Cool. This is kind of the genesis of digital marketer, really, right?
Yeah.
Would you say that if you were going to start again now, if you were you then, now, knowing what you know, obviously now, and the evolution of everything, what would you do? Because that stuff that you did still works.
Yeah.
I mean, not obviously not optimizing for Lycos. It's not as effective as it was
right, yeah.
at one time.
Yeah.
But the ebook and all that, because I was talking to Cole of Cole's Classroom, one of our War Room members, who started taking wedding pictures and then had somebody write a book about how to take baby pictures and then kind of did the same thing. For the people that are listening that haven't started yet that are thinking about doing something, is that what you would do, or would you do something on the socials or something different?
I mean, I think you always need something to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people who say, like, I just want to get active in social media and like build my personal brand and this at some point, and this was the conversation we had with Brendan and with all these other folks, like at some point you got to have something to sell.
Right.
You need to have some way of delivering value to people, or they're not going to be willing to give you money.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
or you're stuck in a dancing bear, like one of the people we had dinner with last night is kind of stuck in that, right?
And that's so, you're either creating the product, you're either going to create a product, or you are the product.
Right.
And I don't think there's a problem with being the product in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you need to do, you want to do service work. Again, I did that.
We're being a product, having a personal brand, I think is very valuable to launch other products. But if that's the thing, that's kind of a challenge,
right? If that's the only thing you have, then eventually you're a racehorse, right? I mean, and as long as you're winning, as long as you're running fast, it's good. And if, you know, you stumble and you break your leg, then you're glue. So I never wanted to be the product. I was willing to do it for a while, but I always wanted to be creating products. And so what I did is I licensed products. I would go to people who had really great ebooks and things, and they obviously weren't selling well. They were poorly titled.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go to them and I'd say, you know, I really love this product. I'd love to be able to offer it to my audience and, you know, and sell it. And I'd love to purchase non-exclusive white label rights to this for you. So you keep selling it, keep all the money.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you $500 if you'll let me take it. I'm going to rebrand it, give it a new title so it won't be competitive. I did that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it can still be done today.
Right. And we have friends that are doing it with influencers like
Absolutely.
Nick Coates and those guys, right?
Happens all the time. So I do believe you need to figure out something of value that you can sell and identify who's a good audience for it. None of that has changed at all. So yeah, I would do the exact same thing. The other thing that I did early on, I learned this from the job that I had at that startup, was I always built lists mm-hmm. first. So I would go out
first.
I would go out and I would do advertising. So like before I would go and license a product from somebody, or before I would go and license, you know, a piece of software, or have something written or have something created.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, I would optimize and get free organic traffic.
Mm-hmm.
But then when that got really hard.
So you write an article, like if you were going to do a book on baby food, you would write an article or something on baby food and rank it.
Well, I wouldn't just want to rank it. I would want to say, if you opt in here, I'll send you this thing. So I wanted to see, would people at least opt in?
Right.
If they weren't interested enough in this subject matter to give me their email address, I knew that they would never give me money.
How'd you come up with the ideas of what to do?
I think
that stops a lot of people.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, at the time, there were different tools, like Google made their search data more available than they do right now. So I would go to the bookstore and I would just peruse the different magazines and I would look at cover stories,
mm-hmm.
you know, for how-to type things. And I'd say, like, that looks interesting. I mean, I remember going and seeing like a home and garden thing and the cover story was how to roll your own sushi. And I went and I looked and I Googled how to roll your own sushi. I'm like, there's not really anything great here
mm-hmm.
for this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a book created on how to roll your own sushi. That particular book, I said I had it created. I actually licensed it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody for a project built a simple website. Like they needed to build a simple how-to website.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they went to some college in the Northeast or something like
right.
that on something they were passionate about. So they built like this website on the step-by-step process of rolling sushi. And they took pictures and everything. I said, this is great. I want to just buy this from you.
Right.
And like, you want to buy it from me? Like, this was a school project.
Right.
Like, and I was like, what would you take for it? And I think they're like, $20. And so I PayPal'd them $20. I got all the content rights to the pictures. And so
That's
I had
so
that
cool.
ebook created, you know, in a matter of days.
And then you had a site.
And then I created a site. And it's like, okay, let's see if we can sell it. I made tens of thousands of dollars selling that product
cool.
while I was, you know, in college that I bought for $20. So it sounds trite, but it is always, I'm going to identify where is a gap in the market.
Mm-hmm. How would you do that today, knowing all the tools that are out there and all that stuff?
I still look at book titles. I still look at magazines
mm-hmm.
and what are the cover stories? What are people talking about? Now you can use tools like BuzzSumo,
mm-hmm.
you know, .com to find out, you know, what are the hot areas? But mostly it comes from just talking to normal people.
Mm-hmm.
I think very often marketers, we get into the tools to try to find where these gaps are. And one of the challenges, everybody's looking at the same tools.
Yeah.
So everybody's identifying, you know, where some of the same potential gaps live. I identify it by just talking to normal people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem with a lot of marketers and a lot of entrepreneurs is they only talk to other marketers and entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
They live in this bubble where they stop talking to just normal people.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that you ultimately want to serve.
Right.
And it's why so many entrepreneurs and marketers wind up creating businesses that serve entrepreneurs and marketers.
Yeah.
Like, and there's just such this proliferation of, you know, I'm going to start a business about how to start a business, teaching people how to start a business, selling right. high ticket consultants. Like, okay.
Yeah. And there are certainly plenty of people and they make money doing it, but
yeah, but I
doesn't serve the value that you would like to.
Well, I think the reason that they wind up there is because it's the only people they talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can't imagine solving somebody else's problem
mm-hmm.
because they don't talk to anybody else. So I would just listen. You know, I'd have conversations with people and listen. That opportunity still exists today.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that it's very difficult to find a truly unmet need.
Mm-hmm. So that is find a need and fill it.
Right.
When I heard that for years and years, I was just like, how?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And especially now, it really isn't about find a need and fill it. All the needs are being filled in some way, shape, or form online. I mean, it is. It's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Content, information, it's become commoditized.
Mm-hmm.
When I sold a book on how to make your own baby food, I won because it was literally the only ebook for sale
right.
on how to do that.
So how do you deal with that now?
Today, we're in an age where brand matters. People want to buy. They want to learn things. They want to be involved in things. They know they could get the information anywhere, but they specifically want to learn it from you. And there's a couple of ways where you can, you know, brand yourself. What you could do is you could go more narrow. So you could say, I'm going to teach this topic. Yeah, a lot of people are teaching this topic, but I want to teach this topic just to this narrower segment.
Mm-hmm.
So you can niche down.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this a lot in software. You see it a lot in the information publishing space.
I like the example of the beer industry. Originally, there was just beer,
yeah,
and then there became foreign and domestic, and then there became the number one selling foreign, and this one's made with this, and this one's filtered with that, and then this one you eat with an orange slice, and so on. And now, I think the last time I looked, there's 38,000 categories.
Yeah.
Categories of beer.
And just about any industry you could do that with,
mm-hmm.
you can niche it down a little bit more, and humans want that, because
mm-hmm.
we all believe ourselves to be, you know, these adorable, beautiful little snowflakes, right? All unique in our own way. And we are to an extent. We're also all remarkably similar.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a digital marketer, we teach marketing.
Mm-hmm.
There are other people who basically take what we teach and what we talk about, and they say, this is marketing for plumbers and HVAC companies.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? And I know that because many of them are our certified partners.
Right.
And we're fine enabling that audience who are taking our content and helping to verticalize it. Right?
And they're adding value as they
absolutely.
Do, because there are tweaks.
There yeah. is value.
So that would be kind of your thing.
I think that's one way to do it. The mm-hmm. other way that you can do it is you can add in a unique perspective or point of view. Right. So you take somebody like Gary Vaynerchuk, for example. He's not really saying anything truly new.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Work hard. Like that's mm-hmm. been said a billion
grind,
times. Right. He's saying it with his own unique perspective and his point of view. And there are people who are going to resonate with that. And there are people who are not.
Mm-hmm.
And he's okay with that. This idea of I need to serve the masses. Just nobody wants that. I want to hear this particular message in a way that's going to resonate with me. You know, so you can
and personalization is a huge thing. So if you can yep. deliver to a very narrow niche with a particular voice in a personalized fashion, that's pretty open market. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity to do that.
Totally. You're not going to say anything new, but you might say the same thing in a slightly different way. There is also still something to be said for, I'm going to say the same thing that everybody else is saying, but I'm going to package it differently,
mm-hmm.
right?
What's an example?
So this gets done in the health space all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? Where this idea of you want to lose weight, drink this shake. No, don't drink this shake, take this pill. No, you don't need to take a pill. You need to apply this patch.
Or categories like don't eat bread, go paleo because our ancestors were, right? That,
right.
To me, that kind of stuff is, finding that story like that is pretty interesting. And the health industry is really good at that.
I think specifically just repackaging it a little bit differently. So if you think about the advice space, right? A book is a way to package it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other people who said, no, I'm going to package this as an audio
mm-hmm.
course. Like think about what Nightingale Conan did.
Yep.
They took the content that was in a book and they just packaged it differently.
Neil Patel, I was just listening to one of his podcasts and he was saying that one of his big things when he started, what was the first blog that he built up?
to Crazy Egg.
One of the first things that he did was he went out to all the blog content and then sent it off to 99 Designs and had the blogs turned into infographics. And the infographics were largely responsible for all of his initial
packaging.
Different packaging.
So there's so many options. There's so many opportunities. I mean, a digital marketer, we took marketing training and we packaged them as certification. Mm-hmm. We took marketing training and we said, join this community and you'll kind of get the training for free. So we packaged it in the form of community. What we've sold hasn't really changed that much, but it was packaged differently. Mm-hmm. And you just see this time and time and time again. I mean, sometimes it's, you look at all the things that are happening on Instagram, right? Movement packaged a watch a little bit differently.
Yeah.
They said, let's do all very modern, minimalistic kind of thing. So I think if you just say, if you just look at it and you say, okay, what is a job that people have always hired something to do, mm-hmm. right? How can I package it differently, mm-hmm. right? Uber simply packaged the taxi industry differently. Facebook.
And really, Uber repackaged the Yellow Pages or 411, because there wasn't a great way to get, how do I find a taxi or transportation? Well, I need to go to a directory that has that. And they're like, how about if we just connected you directly with them?
Yeah. I mean, you think about, we used to hire film and cameras and frames to capture moments of our life and then share them. Right. So I would have to buy a camera, put film in it, take the picture, go and get it developed. So I'd have to hire all these different points so that I could get it printed out and then framed. And now I can put this picture of my family on the mantle. Mm-hmm. So I'd also have to hire a mantle above mm-hmm. my fireplace mm-hmm. to display this thing that happened. And now, you know, through Instagram and through Facebook, you know, you take a picture on your phone, upload it, and now I'm able to accomplish, it does the exact same job.
And you can see it anywhere. You don't even have to be in front of the mantle anymore.
I captured the moment and I shared it.
Right.
Right. In the past, yeah, I had to hire all these different constituencies to get that done. So I think the biggest opportunity, and if you look at the biggest, most disruptive kind of breakthroughs, it was simply the same job to be done in a vastly superior way. So human beings have not changed that much. We always want to generally accomplish the same things. Mm-hmm. So look at the areas of frustration that you see in people's lives and say, like, how can I solve that by packaging it differently? Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the three areas. There's nothing new under the sun. You're not going to find a truly unmet market. But what you can do is you can provide a unique perspective or point of view, like Gary Vaynerchuk. You can niche down and you can, you know, teach the same thing, but to a smaller sliver of the market. Real world example of that, Walmart. Mm-hmm. Retail have been around forever. Walmart said, we're going to go to the places where big box retailers aren't.
Right.
And then eventually surround those. Amazon then did the same thing that Walmart did, just online. So you can niche down and then look to scale up out of those niches, or you can repackage. So those are kind of the three ways that you deal with competition.
So you are a Christian mm-hmm. and not an overly proselytizing one, like some folks you'll meet and they'll tell you right off the bat. I kind of got to know more about you and your faith through that. How does that work with, this is a big question, but I know you can tie these things together. How do you deal with faith and family and work all working together in a way that kind of harmonizes into a good life?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of having a vocation, you know, and just working is not a new concept in the faith community.
Sure. Does it affect your work at all? Because what I've seen that I'll say, and I tell people this, I don't think I've ever told you, is I have learned a lot of patience and understanding for other people. More, I felt like I was okay at it. Actually, I felt like I was good at it. But when we have discussions about somebody that's gone and done some stupid, stupid thing, your approach is very, very kind. And that's helped me to be better in dealing with folks that do those kinds of things. I've always been pretty good at it in a personal life, but in a professional life, it's been more, you know, hey, it's business, come on.
Yeah.
So you've done a good job of that.
There are things that I just believe to be true, and I'm not going to necessarily impose my beliefs, you know, upon others, but there are things that just I believe to be true about the universe and our place in it, right? And so I'm going to order all aspects of my life mm-hmm. around those things that I believe to be true. So I don't all of a sudden believe something different when I show up at work mm-hmm. than I would if I go, you know, to church on Sunday or something like that, or when I'm, you know, talking to my kids. I'm still one set of beliefs, and so I'm always going to be viewing the world through that lens. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I believe, for example, that people are at their core we're sinful. Mm-hmm. Like, people aren't, I don't believe that people are generally good. I think in general, people left to their own devices are gonna kind of do bad things. Like, and I know a lot of people are like, that's just mean, but like, that's what I believe to be true. So when, frankly, when somebody does something that was wrong, mm-hmm. I'm not shocked and appalled by it. It's like, that's kind of what you're gonna do. So, you know, and yet I also know the same is true for me. Mm-hmm. And I know that other people have forgiven me as well. So I'm gonna start with this thing. And so I'm gonna begin from that point. Now, from a business perspective, what I'll say is I can forgive you and we can talk about this stuff. I may not want to do business with you anymore.
Right.
So it doesn't mean that you just get to walk over me. Mm-hmm. And also, I have different roles, you know, in the same way where if it's just me and, you know, I'm really kind of in this like knockdown, drag out, you know, with somebody, I might be way more understanding. But if you do it like and my kids are there and I feel like I need to protect them, I'm not going to be nearly as patient with you than if it's just like us.
Right.
So what role am I occupying in the order of priority? Where do people come? Right. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, I mean, I say when we're in meetings, we you know, do war rooms. So it's like, hey, I got to go. Mm-hmm. I really like you guys. I like my wife and children so much better.
Right.
And people laugh. It's like, I mean it. I really
I like that you tell your kids you like your wife better than your kids, which is kind of a...
Yeah. I mean, again,
it's like... A lot of people don't.
Yeah. The kids are going to leave and cleave and start their own families and... Right. You know, that relationship is not going to be the same forever, but my relationship with my wife will. So right. she gets priority
right.
and then it's the kids and then it's, you know, my dearest, closest friends and that kind of thing. So it, to me, it just simplifies things in business. Just be like, what's kind of the right thing to do? Mm-hmm. You know, when we're thinking about dealing with conflict here at the office, I don't tell people like, oh, go to like Matthew 18, where it talks about here's how you deal with, you know, somebody, but it's like generally, you know, the Bible's
got to be good advice.
Yeah. It has some pretty good advice on how to deal with conflicts. So I'm like, here's kind of how you're going to do it. You're going to go to them and you're going to say, hey, this sort of hurt my feelings. You're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. If they still have an issue and, you know, there's a problem, then you're going to go get somebody else to help like mediate that and explain this, like, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Can you help me out? And if they're still being uncool, then come to me, come to a manager and we'll do it. Again, that's straight out of the book of Matthew. Like,
right.
But it's just good advice. So while I don't outwardly be like, you know, hey, I like Jesus and you should too, or you're fired. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be, I don't think that helps anything. Mm-hmm. I don't make it a secret. And I try to make sure that the things that I do believe to be true permeate all aspects of my life.
What do you read or what are the resources? What do you listen to or watch? Because you're really good at that. You always have... new, fresh perspectives on marketing, branding, and culture and all that stuff. But how do you keep track of that? And how do you find the things in the first place?
Yeah, so generally, I don't read. I don't stay up to date on things that are new and cutting edge. I have no desire to be on the cutting edge of what is new and what is coming down the pike. Because again, my audience doesn't care yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you an example, Snapchat. Mm-hmm. I don't use or care. I've never desired to stay up on that
right.
because I never saw the normal people around me really care that much.
Right.
Instagram started really diving into just in the last 18 months because I saw the normal people around me start to get interested. So I think there's very limited advantage to being first. Mm-hmm. I think what it can actually create are a tremendous number of shiny objects that you chase that lead to nowhere.
Yeah, because a lot of that new stuff isn't going to catch.
It's not going to catch. Yeah. And you know what? When it does... you got time.
Yeah.
Like you'll see it catch. You're like, all right, let's do this. So we've been first to market on almost nothing and I'm totally fine with it. But by the time we go to market, we're ready. So where I get most of my information are books that are 10 plus years old. I read books. I mean, really, I read books that have stood the test of time that are still in print because they still get read and they still get sold.
How do you choose?
I mean, at this point I get, when people know that you read, you get book recommendations all the time. But generally, if I know that if I want to really go deep into a subject matter, I go to Amazon, I type in a keyword related to that subject matter, I buy the top 10 books, and I buy all of them.
Yeah.
And I binge that entire subject matter.
Read or audio?
So what I do is, if audio is available, I will listen to the audiobook. If I can tell that I like it, I switch to reading. Because, and I want to read an actual print book because I like to take notes in the margins and dog ear. Mm-hmm. That's when I actually learn and retain.
Okay.
So if I just listen to something, if I don't write it down or I don't implement it, it's going to be gone pretty quickly.
Okay.
And so I like audio because I can listen to it passively. And if I'm just not feeling it or there's nothing new, I never have to read the book. I do generally, though, buy the book and the audio at the same time, just in case, because if it's good, I'll pause the audio, make a note of where it is, go back to the book and... you know, pick it up.
I do the same thing. And audio, sometimes they'll talk so fast that some resource or something, you're like, I listened to it five times and I was like, I still can't tell what you were saying. So it's really helpful. So anything besides books?
I listen to a lot of podcasts.
You do? Okay.
Yeah, I listen. I mean, so I enjoy topical podcasts, but it's funny. I'll listen to podcasts and I'll like binge listen to a bunch of podcasts, but usually it's topical. Mm-hmm. I mean, I found just the grazing of content mm-hmm. doesn't do me a lot of good.
Okay.
I want to really go deep in a particular subject matter over the course of, you know, 4 to 8 weeks, read the top 10 books, and then begin to build my thesis around it. Like, what's kind of my, mm-hmm. you know, my theory pulling in, okay, I read 10 books and everybody all says the same thing about this area. I'm just going to accept that as truth. You know, this is an area where people tend to disagree or there's multiple perspectives. I'm going to really look and investigate that, or I'm going to try to figure out what perspectives are they coming from? Are these different time frames? Maybe this book was written 40 years ago, this one 20 years ago, this one last year. So sometimes that will inform. So I want to look at, where does everybody agree? Where do they disagree? And it's at the points of disagreement where opportunity lies.
What are you diving into right now?
Right now, I'm really diving heavy into software. So like SaaS,
right?
Yeah, SaaS.
What are the opportunities you see right now?
Simplifying the sales process. Because still most SaaS companies, they shifted their model from the old school terrestrial, we're gonna sell a license, to kind of perpetual license type model. The way software used to be sold, right? You'd go in, you'd sell a perpetual license for this particular, maybe you'd have a maintenance contract, but in general, you'd have the big sale up front. The innovation that Mark Benioff made with Salesforce is, we're going to do software as a service, we're going to charge on a subscription mm-hmm. based. So although they shifted kind of the financial model around how they charge, they haven't really shifted the way in most cases that things are sold. Mm-hmm. So they're still sold through long sales cycle, consultative selling.
It's actually annoying as an online person when you go look at something and you have to set up a demo.
I just want to buy it. And this is not exactly. So some of the biggest breakthroughs have happened to companies who went direct to consumer mm-hmm. in a B2B enterprise space. So if you look at MailChimp, did this and just kind of dominated by having a free trial and like, look, just go and sign up. I see big opportunities in taking that idea up market. So just go ahead and sign up. And it's nothing really, really new. Lots of companies are doing
so,
it.
So like having say some, a $250,000 Oracle contract.
Yeah. You know, the idea is this land and expand model, right? Go ahead, start small, allow people to sign up, and then expand out. Mm-hmm. I still think that there's tremendous opportunities there, because if you look at most of the really big companies, they're still selling in the old way. And so you kind of have very consumer-y type software that's targeting very, very small businesses, and then you have the enterprise. Mm-hmm. And there's this big gap in the middle of companies that are like our size company, you know, companies that are definitely not small,
yeah,
but we're not enterprises, and we'll just go and buy the dang thing if you'll let me just buy it.
Right.
And I think a lot of companies would be served to make it easier to buy on the front end, and then you put way more of your quote-unquote sales effort on keeping the sale and making it more, you know, making sure that it actually gets implemented on the back end.
So you've already got a subscriber because of the trial or whatever.
Yep.
You didn't have to do the demo.
Yep.
So you need fewer people or at least less time, because that's a big time suck, having people have to schedule and
totally.
All that loss.
Yep.
And now they have signed up. So what's the function of the sales department at that point?
Basically, product is doing a lot of the marketing. Marketing is doing a lot of the selling.
Right.
And sales is actually doing a lot of the success and support.
Okay.
Is kind of, I think, where that shift has taken place. I'm not the first person to observe this. I'm repeating things that other people have said.
So should you have marketing and sales separate?
So yeah, we've gone back and forth on this. I do still think that culturally those departments are different enough that they should, I think they can all be on the same revenue team.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that the function of marketing is very different, and just the cadence of work is very different in marketing than it is in sales.
Okay.
Even if you're thinking about sales as more like of a post-transaction onboarding, let's make sure that you're successful, let's look to expand and to get you
that
know,
sounds
get
more like customer success. So is sales and customer success kind of the
same
thing?
Yeah, sales and customer success, we really do have aligned mm-hmm. very closely, those two departments. When it comes to these organizational charts, I like to group people together based on more on the cadence of work.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, you know, if you're in sales or you're in success, you're in support, you know, every day you're going to show up and you're going to need to talk to customers. Like, that's what you're doing. Like, you're on the phone or you're answering tickets, or you're just processing through, and the next day there's going to be a bunch more. Marketing is different in that marketing, you're going to be running campaigns, and you might work on something for a week and then it'll go out, and then you'll kind of tweak it and you'll come back maybe a couple months later and do another one,
mm-hmm.
right? The cadence of work
mm-hmm.
in marketing when it's being done that way and the cadence of work in sales are so different that it's really hard to have them, because their timelines, the unit of measurement they speak in, are just fundamentally different.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I think you got to kind of have them separate.
So with all the things that you're studying and all the things that are going on in the market and the SaaS focus, what's what's next for the digital marketer companies?
So for digital marketer in particular, I want to continue to see the community itself expand. And, you know, I mentioned, I think more of the classic salespeople, they're having to get better at marketing. Mm-hmm. So I see digital marketing growing by salespeople becoming marketers, mm-hmm. realizing that, you know, I need to get better at prospecting, which means I need to get better at things like social and email, mm-hmm. and doing some, you know, some of that. Like, you know, there's this whole movement, account-based marketing, you know, mm-hmm. ABM.
Yep.
That's kind of the merger at the enterprise level between marketing and sales. A lot of, let's basically teach marketing to salespeople. So I see digital marketer beginning to serve a much broader audience as salespeople mm-hmm. come in, as well as serving the agencies and the consultants who are taking the ideas and the concepts and niching them down, splintering them down to those verticals. And we just want to continue to support the community
okay.
that's out there. Look to grow. I mean, obviously, we're working on some acquisitions right now for some other brands that will allow us to go upmarket because mm-hmm. the enterprises still want marketing training. But the ethos of digital marketer is still very much small to medium-sized businesses. Mm-hmm. It's still very much, you know, owner-operator, startup, entrepreneur. Like, it's not the kind of thing that is probably going to get taken, you know, into a Fortune 500 company.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of rolling some other brands into the fold that can go into those, but mm-hmm. still teaching stuff that actually works. Because mm-hmm. so much of what gets taken to the large companies is, you know, really old and right. outdated. But we just want to continue to serve this community.
Rolling brands in brings up integration. And I know we just sold a controlling interest in Traffic and Conversion. So yep. we're going through being integrated
yeah.
at the same time in one of our companies. What have you learned about that from the process of the couple companies we've bought and now one major exit as far as helping people or helping deal with that process or preparing for it?
I think you got to accept going in that it's going to be tough mm-hmm. Because it is. I mean, there's a lot of square peg round hole type moments, you know, in any of these things. I mean, they were totally separate companies. I think a lot of it's like integrating a family.
Yeah.
You know, when you have like the Brady Bunch kind of thing coming together.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of that.
Jan.
Nobody liked her. There's a lot of just emotional stuff. There's a lot of tribal knowledge around, you know, here's how we do it, but here's how we do it.
Right.
What I learned, and we did this on the traffic conversion side with our new partners there, mm-hmm. is kind of stating at the outset, these are the areas where we feel like we are astoundingly and amazingly great.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to go and change these things, you're probably going to get some pushback from us, even if you're right.
Right.
Because we feel an emotional attachment to those.
Okay.
So
was there anything like that that you identified that then you did actually say it made sense to change?
So the way that we did some of our promotional timing, the mm-hmm. way that we would send out different, you know, emails and things like that, we said, like, we know this works and we feel really good about this. And they've made some suggestions like, well, have you thought about trying this? And just around the timing and when you do price increases, where we said, like, actually, that's a good idea. We should try that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, had they said that from the outset, had they just said, well, here's how we do things, we'd have pushed back.
It'd have been hard, yeah.
So I think acknowledging, like, where could we potentially fight? Because nobody argues over things that they don't care about at all,
mm-hmm.
right? It's almost
a consultative integration.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And before anybody has said anything,
mm-hmm.
once people have started making suggestions, how do you do this? How do you do this? Well, we do it this way. It's too late. Before you even do the integration, it's okay. What are the areas that you feel like you're amazingly great at? Like, I need that list of
yes,
things.
Yes.
If you feel like you just crush and you own social, I don't want to touch that right now.
Right.
What are the areas where you feel like you're not as good at?
Yeah.
Let's see if we can't integrate the areas where we think we're good at and you acknowledge you suck at.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair? So you say, we're amazingly great at this. Please don't touch this. This is a hill I'm prepared to die on. This, I know for a fact we suck at. Anything you can do here would be really, really helpful. Let's try to start there and get a simple win. Mm-hmm. And maybe we look at it and go like, yeah, we kind of suck that area too. So, you know, but ideally there's going to be some place where you can start where, you know, they've got a deficiency, they've got a gap. You know that you can help fill that. Do that one first to just build some trust mm-hmm. and create some of the benefit of the doubt. Having that clear on the front end so that you know and you're not arguing over. It's like there's some people like, I, you know, you can have conversations about religion or politics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some people you just can't.
Yes.
Like, it is so ingrained that if you bring that up, it's not going to be a fun conversation.
Right.
What is the religion and politics to them?
Right.
And talk about that on the front end and then say, okay, here's where we start. I think that was kind of the biggest, that was something that we did. And I'm glad that we did it
mm-hmm.
because those areas where we're like, this is kind of a hill we're prepared to die on, they haven't really touched.
Right.
And it's worked out fine.
And yet you have been open to improvement in them, which is kind of cool.
I'm open to improvement, especially now that I know, one, they're really good. Mm-hmm. The areas where we needed help, they've stepped in and have been great. Mm-hmm. So that trust was built. Now that I know that I don't have to change, because they're like, yeah, I mean, if there's something you feel great at, like, I'll make a suggestion, mm-hmm. but it's not a mandate, mm-hmm. right? That I think is important.
As we sign off, what are your top three favorite wines in the world these days?
Oh, Sloan has entered the top three.
Nice. You stole my 2006 Sloan that
I
left in your care for us to share together as friends.
I was very excited about that.
That's great stuff.
I finally cracked open.
We have to go. I have to get you to meet Martha because the winemaker is super, super cool.
Yeah. I'm giving ones that, because Colgan mm-hmm. and Bond mm-hmm. obviously are there, but it's kind of not fair.
Okay.
Right. I think that some of these are just at a different. So I'm kind of thinking that one of the ones that I drink, because unlike you, mm-hmm. You'll just go and open up a Colgan or a Bond because it's a Tuesday. I still have an issue with that. Like for me, that there's like wines.
You'll get past that for sure.
There's wines that like I celebrate with.
As
or, like,
you look at your collection and you've got to be there already, you're going to be like, why am I drinking this thing that is good when I've got all these that are great that I really probably am never going to get to because I just don't drink that much.
Yeah, you're right. I'm not there yet. I may get there, but I'm not there yet. I look
but
at
But you
like,
admit that you have it.
I do. Yeah. No, okay. I don't think I'm right, by the way. Okay. Yeah, no, I'm not arguing my case. I'm saying you're right. I'm just still going to be irrational.
Okay. So we'll say Colgan, Bond, top three all time and then top three that you think you like that you will drink.
Yeah.
How about that? Colgan, Bond, Sloan?
No, I mean, Sloan would kind of be in that next level. So Colgan, Bond, I haven't drank enough of the Scarecrow, but when we had it that one time,
man, that's so good.
That was absolutely astounding. Same with the Harlan.
That's so interesting.
All those would sort of be in there.
And I got to get you into Futo too. That's
never had that.
Yeah.
The really like Sloan. Four Winds.
I haven't had Four Winds.
That is still one of my favorites. Not that crazy. Mm-hmm. And kind of in that same grouping as the Donna Onda.
And also Realm. Like Realm the Bard. I don't know if you've
have it. Love it. I don't have enough of it.
Yeah.
Like, remember, he didn't let us. You've probably gone back a billion times since then, but I don't have enough of it that I'm drinking it often.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, like, what are the ones that I've had that are amazing? What are the ones that I drink fairly regularly because I know I can get more?
Yeah.
And so that.
That LaCroix is pretty great that's sitting over
LaCroix
there.
LaCroix is absolutely outstanding. It's kind of a tweener, though. I don't, in that it's not necessarily a top
totally
three.
Agree. Yeah.
But it's not as readily available as some of the other ones.
Yes. Yeah.
So, well, and Checkerboard would be in that same kind of grouping as well.
Yeah.
As La Jolla. So there
we
you go.
Have to get back to Napa. That's what I'm getting from this.
I agree.
Thank you for being on the show. Really appreciate it. And for people that want to connect with you and your companies, what's the best, or our companies, I should say, what's the best way for them to do that?
What I heard from you is that you just gave me your shares in the company. So thank
you
for that.
Yes.
And it's documented. I'm funny at Twitter. I love Twitter. So if you kind of at me on Twitter.
So Twitter, MySpace, and.
Definitely not MySpace. Yeah, I'm all over MySpace. Friendster. No. Twitter and LinkedIn. I really like LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn's great.
Facebook is not me on the business side. It's company stuff. Less on Instagram. I don't take a lot of pictures
because
I'm just still fairly private.
Okay.
I post stuff with my kids and people make weird comments. I'm like, I don't freaking know you,
yeah,
stranger.
That's not cool.
So Twitter.
LinkedIn, Twitter.
LinkedIn, Twitter.
Are you just Ryan Dice?
I'm at Ryan Dice.
At Ryan Dice.
RyanDeiss. It's German. When two vowels go walking, the second one does the talking like the wine.
Awesome.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier, brought to you by Digital Marketer. For more information and show notes, go to digitalmarketer.com/podcast. Thank you for listening.